From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy. Our topic on this edition of the program, U.S. policy towards the Middle East. Our guest, Hisham Melhem. He's a columnist for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based satellite channel. Previously, Hisham was the Washington bureau chief of Al Arabiya. He is also the correspondent for Anahar, the leading Lebanese daily. For 4 years, he hosted Across the Ocean. That's a weekly current affairs program on U.S.-Arab relations for Al Arabiya, and he writes a weekly column for Al Arabiya's English website. Hisham Melhem's writings appear in numerous publications, ranging from the literary journal Al Mawakaf in Beirut to the Los Angeles Times, the Huffington Post, as well as in magazines such as Foreign Policy, Politico, and Middle East Policy. Hisham Melhem interviewed U.S. President Barack Obama for Al Arabiya in what was the president's first ever sit-down interview. Well, we'll talk with Hisham about the political and regional implications of the recently concluded nuclear deal with Iran, as well as his take on the Obama administration's overall handling of policy toward the greater Middle East. And Hisham Melhem joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm delighted, as always, to welcome my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Thank you.
Well, Hisham, first let's go to the Iran deal. I'd like to get your opinion on it. Do you think the advantages of the deal outweigh many of the disadvantages or shortcomings that the critics are talking about?
Let me start by saying eventually Iran will become a nuclear power. Iran, after this deal, will become a threshold nuclear power. Assuming that Iran will play by the rules for the next 10 years, Iran will maintain all of its physical infrastructure, with the exception of dismantling the core reactor at the Arak facility. But the whole infrastructure will remain. More importantly, the scientific knowledge will remain. And Iran will continue to improve its technical skills in the next 15 years in terms of the work of its scientists and research. It will be producing some uranium, not enough. Of course, the road to producing plutonium is cut off. There is an inspection regime that can work, assuming that Iran collaborates with the international community. But essentially, Iran is on its way to become a real nuclear power. Iran does not want, at this stage, to become a nuclear power. I think if they do become a nuclear power in the next, you know, a year or two, assuming that we don't have an agreement, that will force the Turks and the Arabs to engage Iran in a nuclear arms race. And I don't think the Iranians at this stage need it. What they are doing in the region does not require a nuclear program.
Do I take that as you're in favor of the deal? Do you think the deal is better than not having a deal, or could it have been better negotiated?
If you talk specifically about the nuclear part, yes, it's not a bad deal. My problem with the administration is not the technical part of the deal, is Iran's policy in the region and the total failure of this administration to address Iran's nefarious activities, malign activities throughout the region. The administration is not talking at all about human rights violations in Iran. In fact, the administration let down the Iranian people in 2009 when they rebelled in the streets in a peaceful way. And the president did not really respond to their legitimate yearning for democracy and empowerment. So my problem with the administration is Iran as the regional hegemon. It's not Iran as the country that is developing some nuclear knowledge. Look, you know, the Iranians look around them in the region and they say 8 years ago there was no such thing as Pakistan. Today, there is a state named Pakistan with 100 nuclear warheads. We are Persia. We are the inheritors of a great pre-Islamic civilization. We are the inheritors of a great Islamic civilization. We have a permanency. We have civilizational heft. When you negotiate with great cultures like the Chinese or the Iranians or the Indians, these people have a sense of continuity, have a sense of permanence, have a sense of identity. They have a sense of empowerment and they have a sense of entitlement. And that's what you have with Iran. I mean, I feel sorry sometimes for American officials or European officials negotiating with a country like that, because those negotiators on the Iranian side don't act according to 4-year cycle or 6-year cycle or whatever. And in the end, let me be blunt about this. For a country that measures its history in millennia and centuries, what is it to delay or to suspend or to freeze any program for 10 years or 15 years? It's merely a fleeting moment in the history of that country. That's what you have to keep in mind.
Hisham, with respect to their political activities in the region, Iran, that is, its nefarious activities, President Obama said He's aware of that, but he wanted to get the nuclear file out of the way. Some people are saying, analysts, that, okay, the nuclear file is done now. Perhaps the administration can address this. They can compartmentalize. Do you think that that is possible, that this administration will become tougher vis-a-vis Iran's activities, whether in supporting its proxies in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, Lebanon, or elsewhere, especially because there's going to be a so-called windfall, that is, sanctions relief, if indeed they comply with the agreement vis-a-vis the nuclear issue, that sanctions will be lifted. And, of course, many in the Gulf region, Sunni Gulf states, and Israel, of course, in particular, are worried that this will embolden Iran, furthering its activities. Do you think, one, that's true? And if so, is this administration and other P5+1 powers now ready to confront Iran?
No, they are ready to do business with Iran. You know, we've seen already the Minister of Economy from Germany, already in Tehran. The Foreign Minister of France, Laurent Fabius, said he's going to Iran. Watch in the next few weeks and months when the Iranians begin to implement the agreement, and they will implement it initially because they need sanction relief. You're going to see a caravan of diplomats and businessmen from Europe, the West, China, and in the Far East going to Tehran to do business. There is an economic Iranian treasure that could reach $150 billion, assuming that Iranian money will be unfrozen and released and given to Iran. People want to do business with Iran, including our friends in Europe, particularly the French and the Germans. So that's what you're going to see. You're not going to see a Western confrontation with Iran. Theoretically, the president may be correct. Yes, we can confront Iran now. But essentially and practically, the president is collaborating with Iran on the ground in Iraq against their common enemy, which is ISIS, or as the president called it, ISIL. The United States, and if you hear senior American officials, both in the military and on the civilian side, speak privately, but directly and explicitly, we are not hitting Bashar al-Assad's forces in Syria because we don't want the Iranian response to come back to haunt us in Iraq in the form of IED against our people and against our personnel in Iraq. We are being held hostage, essentially, to Iran's regional machinations and Iran's regional ambitions. The president, as I said, believes that he can collaborate with Iran, and he is unfortunately correct. The Arabs are very weak. The Arabs are not united. They are, in fact, a house divided. It's not only a house divided, it's a house with no roof. And some of the rooms are in flames, Syria and Iraq. And Egypt is drifting. You know, Egypt unmoored itself, if you will. So there is no Arab power. And 3 years ago, I wrote an article in Foreign Policy, and the title was Arabs in the Shadows of Their Neighbors. And by that, I meant their neighbors, the Israelis, the Iranians, and the Turks. There is no Arab marja'iyah, as we say in Arabic. There is no Arab center where one can go to or hope that that center would provide leadership in the Arab world. And that's the problem that we face now. And this agreement came into fruition at a time when there's a perception in the region. You can argue about whether it's correct or not. There's a perception in the region that the United States is in decline, that the Arab world is divided, that Iran now will be on a new phase of ascendancy. This agreement means that the international community is recognizing Iran as a regional power and that Iran came back from the cold.
We're taking a short break. We'll be right back.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the controversial presidential election in Burundi as Nkurunziza is set to win a third term, and on the ongoing process of lifting presidential term limits in Rwanda that will allow President Kagame to run again. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. That's next time on VOA Africa.
We're talking with Hisham Melham. He's a columnist for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based satellite channel. And now let me turn to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi, for a question.
Hisham, could the deal offer a better chance for seeking Iran's help in the fight against ISIS?
Already, the United States is collaborating with Iran and ISIL. I mean, there was a joke told to me by an Iraqi friend of mine, senior official, Iraqi Kurdish friend of mine. I asked him, how are things in Iraq? And he said, well, things are okay. I mean, General Austin, the head of the Central Command, is in charge of the air campaign, and General Qasem Soleimani is in charge of the land campaign against ISIL. We laughed, but that's the reality. Today, the Iraqi army is a hollow institution, does not have a fighting spirit. It has a lousy leadership. After all the billions that we spent as American taxpayers, we wasted it on this regime in Iraq. And now the so-called Hashd al-Sha'bi, the popular mobilization movement, the militias that are mostly sectarian Shia militias, fighting a sectarian Sunni group like ISIL. But General Qasemi is the ever-smiling, cocky Iranian leader that you see taking pictures with the Peshmerga forces and with the Shia militias and with the senior Iraqi officials. In fact, on his latest trip to Iran, General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, was told by the Iraqi leaders, you know, lay off Iran. Lay off Iran. Stop criticizing the Iranians. We need them. So this is what you have now. Call it an alliance of convenience. Call it an alliance of whatever. But the United States in Iraq is dealing and collaborating with Iran, and they are doing the coordination through a hapless Iraqi government.
I have a quick question, because to what extent do you think, Hisham, that really the rise of ISIL is at least in part due to the fact that Shiite-led government in Iraq that we helped, that is the United States, simply ignored the many, many smoldering grievances by the Sunni population who, because their grievances weren't then addressed, then felt themselves between a so-called rock and a hard place. They feared the Shiite-led government that was cracking down on them. And when ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, comes, who are really extremely violent as well, but they tend to ally themselves with them. So in a way, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of both Iran and even perhaps the United States by not putting more pressure on the new Prime Minister al-Hadi to address these Sunni grievances. And then the same thing in Syria. Bashar al-Assad is an Alawite, an offshoot of Shia Islam, is a longtime ally of Iran. I mean, his very presence is anathema to the Sunni Gulf states. I mean, to what extent do these things actually fuel the rise of ISIL and ISIS and, you know, sort of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy?
That's true. Look, now we are seeing almost a repeat of what happened 2006 and 7 and 8 when al-Qaeda in Iraq under Zarqawi exploited the Sunni grievances in al-Anbar region. And the fact that the Sunnis have been marginalized in the new regime, especially under Nouri al-Maliki, who was a disaster for the Iraqis and for American-Iraqi relationship. And we in the United States, through both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, dealt with this man for 8 years when we knew, particularly the Obama administration, that he's practicing these sectarian policies that are designed to further marginalize the Sunnis. It's true that the Sunnis of Iraq ruined Iraq in the last 80 years. I mean, they were in charge of Iraq's inception as a modern nation. But that does not mean that now that they are a minority, that they should be totally marginalized. And now we see that alienation. They supported initially al-Qaeda, or at least collaborated with them, and now they are collaborating, or some of them collaborated or wanted to collaborate with this new metastasized al-Qaeda or ISIS or ISIL, 10 times worse than al-Qaeda in that sense. So yes, I mean, we are in part partially responsible for the rise of this monstrous phenomena called ISIS, in part because we did not stress that Iraq should respect the basic rights of its own people and refrain from these sectarian practices. And now all of us are paying a price. The Iraqi people are paying a price. The American people are paying a price. This president was forced to send back troops, albeit, you know, a few thousand. He doesn't want to call them boots on the ground. I don't know what they're wearing, sandals. So, there is in part an American responsibility for this mess. That's why when we criticize the United States, people say, well, the Iraqis should fix their world. Absolutely. Arabs should fix their world. I'm a big believer in human agency. I'm a big believer that the Arabs are first and foremost responsible for the incredible chaos that their societies are in right now. Now we've seen the accumulation of all these bad governance, the repression, the autocracy, religious extremism, sectarianism that are mainly or in the main responsible for the breakdown of Iraq and Syria and the marginalization of Egypt. So I always blame the Arabs because they should be responsible. But there is an American responsibility. The invasion of Iraq unleashed incredible forces that led to this situation that we find ourselves in right now.
And you said that President Obama then, in contrast to George W. Bush, you said he overlearned Iraq in many ways, in the sense that perhaps now when we should have intervened, if not boots on the ground, some more diplomatic pressure, we didn't.
When we talk about American intervention, the last thing I want is to see one American Marine die for Syria or for Iraq or for anybody, to be honest with you, unless it is really a clear case, cut case of self-defense, okay? But that does not mean you cannot practice American leadership or conduct American leadership in an effective way. I mean, I cannot believe for a moment that the United States could not have intervened and put pressure on Turkey, for instance, to stop the infiltration through its border to Syria. I cannot believe that the United States could not have stopped Maliki earlier.
Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, there are many ways where this president was not engaged. Now, one could say, well, from his own perspective, his overriding agenda was domestic, you know, healthcare and all that. That's fine. But you can compartmentalize about this thing, you know. And
Syria.
Yes.
You don't draw a red line and then you don't fulfill it. You lose credibility around the world.
That was the worst decision. Look, I always advise myself and advise everybody that every 2 or 3 years I reread Machiavelli. I studied political theory. I did my PhD in political theory. I'm the product of Western culture in that sense. And Machiavelli has a special place in my mind. And you should read Machiavelli because you learn something about leadership. Machiavelli says it's better to be respected and even hated than to be loved, because those who love you today may hate you tomorrow. But those who fear you or respect you, when we don't create a sense of fear and dread in the hearts of our enemies, you cannot be treated and respected as a great power. The United States should act as the great power that it is. Sometimes I think this president may no longer believe that this country on its own is still capable of doing great things. And Syria was a test. Bashar took his measure. The Ayatollahs took his measure, and they realized he does not like to use force. Now, I want him to be cautious. Every American president should be cautious. But as I said, if George Bush was a bit reckless with the use of power, this American president went the other extreme. That's why I said he learned too much, so to speak, from Iraq.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Hisham Melham, world-renowned columnist for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based satellite channel. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, along with senior VOA Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA, or send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. And here's a shout out to a faithful listener, Facebook fan, Mitra Qureshi from Kabul, Afghanistan. And now a question from Mohammed.
Hisham, the other front to encounter ISIS is Syria. UN envoy to Syria is consulting with Syrian parties about convening Geneva 3. Do you think that the United States would invite Iran this time to ensure a different outcome?
There are people in Washington and maybe in the region who are saying, since Iran is part of the problem, Iran should be part of the solution. I really don't think that this is likely to happen. I don't see most of those who are active on the ground in Syria, the fighting forces, especially the Islamists and the others, would be willing to sit down in the same room with Iran, with the main power that is supporting their tormentor, the regime of Bashar al-Assad. I think what the United States should do, or what the regional powers, if they are serious, really, is to, as I said, try to stop the flow of fighters going to Syria and to take some serious measures against the regime. Look, Bashar al-Assad's regime was the magnet that drew all of these forces. It was the magnet that drew all of these crazy volunteers from Europe and from the rest of the Arab world. It's his massacres that drew all of these people. It may be too late, I hope not, but it may be too late to save Syria as a unitary state. But it's not too late to check this regime, at the same time also to check and turn back ISIS. But you have to give the Syrian people the hope that we learned something from the last 4 or 5 years of bloodletting, that the source of all the problems in Syria is that autocratic, repressive, ugly regime of Bashar al-Assad. You know, people say, well, ISIS is killing people. Bashar al-Assad killed infinitely more people. Bashar al-Assad systematically, as the head of a state, has been killing people systematically. I don't want to diminish or belittle the crimes of ISIS, but in the end, we should keep our eyes on the real problem, which is the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And unless and until the United States help the Syrian people to undermine this awful, monstrous regime, nobody is going in the opposition is going to take them seriously. This country invested some money and wanted to train and equip Syrian fighters for the sole purpose of fighting ISIS. Not fighting the main tormentor of the Syrian people, not fighting the source that drove these Syrians to pick up arms and fight the regime, when their peaceful demonstrations early on, almost for a full year, 7, 8, 9 months, were crushed brutally by the regime at a time when the President of the United States called on the Syrian president to step down, by the time the American president said, if you cross the red line and use chemical weapons, you will force me to change my calculus. No. And unless the President of the United States addresses this issue, nobody's going to take us seriously.
How about the impact of the deal on the role of Hezbollah in Syria?
Hezbollah is deeply involved in Syria, and I can tell you, I don't think anybody would disagree that it is Iran through its proxies and through its direct help to Damascus that saved the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. It's not Russia, it's not China, it is Iran and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is deeply involved in this sectarian war, unfortunately, that's taking place there. I don't know how long can Hezbollah bleed in Syria without undermining itself in Lebanon, without forcing its own base to take a harsh look at the reality. And now Hezbollah is anathema to most people in the Arab world, while in 2006, when Hezbollah was fighting Israel, they were held as heroes. Now they are held as, correctly, as the stooges and the pawns and the proxies of Iran.
Is there anybody in the administration that sees it this way, that sees Assad as the root of the problem, really?
Look, you may have some people in the administration like Samantha Power or maybe even John Kerry in his heart of hearts. The problem is that the Syria policy or the Iraq policy or the Iran policy is directed from the White House. And everybody does the bidding for the President of the United States, Barack Obama. He is really the chief architect of the American foreign policy in the region and even beyond. Look, I quibble with his strategic view, but if there is a theoretician, if there is someone with some heavyweight and has a certain view of the world, it is the President of the United States. It's Barack Obama. We don't have anybody at the Defense Department or at the State Department or at the National Security Council. We don't have a Zbigniew Brzezinski. We don't have a Brent Scowcroft. So there is only one source, which is the President of the United States. And he's the one who's calling the shots. And during the negotiations with Iran, everybody had to look at the White House. So it's the president who calls the shots.
Well, speaking of the president, he also called the shots in Yemen, and he was touting Yemen as a great success. Mm-hmm. Well, I think he might have a different view if he looked at it today. Yemen is now engulfed in civil war, again, a proxy war between the Houthis, who have grievances of their own, independent of Iran, but perhaps are getting help from Iran. And then you have Saudi Arabia now attacking Yemen, trying to vanquish the Houthi and bring back President Hadi. But now we're seeing a very perverse, bizarre alliance because of the hatred toward the Houthi, Saudi Arabia. Now we see even partnering with Al-Qaeda, the very, you know, elements that we, that is the United States, has been trying to defeat for all these years in a very robust counterterrorism strategy. And Yemen, Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, is probably the most dangerous of its branches because they have tried to attack the United States.
Yemen is facing what we say here in the United States, a perfect storm. You have more than one civil war. You have a secessionist movement in the south. You have the Houthi rebellion, which has been going on for years. Most of the world discovered it last year, but it's been going on for a long time. Yemen is running out of drinking water, and there are people in Yemen who are hungry. So all of these problems now are facing us. There's no military solution in Yemen. Iran did not create the Houthi problem. Iran exploited it.
Exactly.
And Iran has been doing a very good job exploiting that just to put pressure on the Saudis. And the Saudis look at Yemen as the way we look at Mexico. This is really part and parcel of our national security interests, and we cannot allow a situation like that. And any meddling on the part of Iran touches them really in a very sensitive area. This is more important to them than Bahrain. So I think they were very concerned, and they upped the ante militarily without really thinking through what could happen on the ground. Yemen is a mountainous country. I was born in Lebanon, in a very mountainous country. I know mountainous people. When I had cancer, I wrote to my friends and I said, I have cancer, but I'm a mountain man. I'm going to beat it. And I know these people are very tough. So that's part of the difficulty that you have in Yemen. One would hope that if the Houthis have been checked a little bit, that this will force them to go to the bargaining table. The Saudis don't tell you that the Houthis are not an integral part of Yemen, because they are an integral part of Yemen, and they should be a part of the solution. And one would hope, with pressure from the international community, that they will go back to the bargaining table and come up with some sort of resolution. The Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which was based in Yemen, is a very dangerous bunch of people. And they tried to bring their havoc to the United States, as we've seen with the so-called underwear bomber and all that. So the United States should be concerned about that, and the United States should be involved in finding a political solution to Yemen.
Well, Hisham, with respect to Yemen, once again, we find ourselves, you know, in a situation where we had some victories, but many critics earlier, before this civil war, this civil conflict broke out, were criticizing the Obama administration for too much emphasis on a counterterrorism strategy to the detriment of development. And now that counterterrorism strategy is up in smoke, where we have even elements of Al-Qaeda partnering with the U.S. ally, Saudi Arabia, against Houthi, only because, you know, they're the only
Well, I mean, you know, when you make these tactical decisions, you lose sight of the big strategic vision, if you will, for a united Yemen, free of all of these groups. And I think it's a mistake if anybody's collaborating with Al-Qaeda. It's like collaborating with the devil. That requires really a political vision as to the future of Yemen. Absolutely, you're not going to solve Yemen's problem by strictly engaging in coin, as they say, counterinsurgency, to address the issue of development. I was struck, to be honest with you, when they reached an agreement with Ali Abdullah Saleh, the former president, and allowed him to stay. This is the incarnation of Mephistopheles, if you will. He's been around for 36 years. He's a great manipulator. And they allowed him to stay in Yemen. And now everybody's paying a price. First and foremost, the Yemeni people. That requires a great deal of collaboration on the part of the Saudis, GCC, hopefully some pressure on the Iranians, UN international intervention.
What about Oman?
Oman doesn't want to get involved in these things. Oman has a great relationship with Yemen. Oman is the place where the United States and Iran engaged in secret diplomacy for a long time. Oman is against the GCC intervention in Yemen. So Oman is, you know, marginalized itself or neutralized itself, if you will.
But that's why I thought it could be a moderator or an intermediary.
I don't think they carry that kind of regional weight that will influence the Saudis. But I think the Saudis and everybody else and the United States should present the Yemeni warring parties with a vision that, look, if peace prevails, if we have an extended ceasefire, there will be money for development because it is in our interest, all of us, to develop Yemen or at least to prevent Yemen from falling into total chaos.
Hisham, Congress has a 60-day window to review the nuclear deal with Iran. How do you expect the pro-Israeli lobby impact on the congressional debate?
It will have an impact. It will have an impact. But I think there are Democrats who have their own legitimate questions and concerns about the deal, regardless of their views on Israel. Look, we all know that the Republican Congress, both the House and the Senate, will vote against the deal. But the issue here, what will happen after the presidential veto? Then the Republicans have a problem. They have to attract 13, 14 members of the Senate, at least, the Democrats, so that they will have two-thirds majority to undermine or to reject the presidential veto. This is where the fight is going to be. And if you notice, what the administration is very concerned because in the next 2 months, the Republicans are going to take the battle to the districts and to the states where these Democrats are running in 2016. And they are trying to scare them. If you support the deal, you may lose your career politically. And this is where the fight is. And that's why the president goes on Jon Stewart. That's part of the campaign. And there will be a tremendous campaign. And this week we've seen that already the Congress began to call in senior members of the administration to be grilled in Congress about this deal. The Israeli government committed itself to work against, to undermine this deal. Obama came and made his case in the Congress of the United States, much to the chagrin of the United States. I thought this was a bad move, but that's another issue. And by the way, if you look at the Jewish community, American Jews are true to themselves in the sense that they don't think like a tribe. They have a multiplicity of views, which tells you something about the political sophistication of Jewish organizations and Jewish electorate. But AIPAC, as the main pro-Israeli lobby, and I would call it pro-Israeli lobby, I don't call it Jewish lobby.
It's important to make that distinction.
Of course. They have committed themselves to spend tens of millions of dollars to shoot down this agreement. But there are also influential Jewish groups who are supporting the group. So it's going to be interesting for us as journalists and as observers to watch how the battle will unfold.
As we close, Hisham, some final thoughts with respect to President Obama's legacy in the Middle East from his Cairo speech in 2009. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what would be your assessment of Obama's legacy in the Middle East and the Arab world from the point of view of the people in the region?
I think a lot of people would be disappointed with this performance. If you look around, the president has very little to show for in the Middle East except the Iranian deal. And assuming that it will pass, that will be his legacy in the Middle East. But that has nothing to do with the Cairo speech, opening up a new page with the Muslim world and with the Arab world in terms of helping them in terms of democracy, empowerment, better relationship with the United States. We've seen a great deal of alienation between both the peoples of the Arab world, let me be specific about this, and the leaderships of the Arab world. And by the way, if you look at the whole region, this is one of the few moments where you have the American president not having good relationship with the Israelis, the Arabs, and the Turks. And maybe he's improving his relationship with the Iranians. That is ironic, to say the least.
Hisham Melhem is a columnist for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based satellite channel. Hisham, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and joining me on the program was Senior VOA Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.